As you know, our Torah is read through annually in a weekly cycle. A few hours before Mr. Sadat's plane was to land on a Saturday night near Jerusalem, the synagogue was filled with the chant of the portion known as Vayishlach. It consists largely of the 32nd and 33rd chapters of the book of Genesis, the tale of reconciliation, the reconciliation of the brothers, Jacob and Esau. Vayisa Yaakov et enav, vayar, v'hine Esav va. And Jacob lifted up his eyes, he looked, and behold, Esau was coming. And I suspect that there were very few who heard that cantorial chant, that reading of the Torah that day, who did not make some analogy between those days and this day, particularly if they were at all aware of the burden of our Jewish exegetical tradition, which had over the centuries always identified Esau with Edom, with Rome, with the enemies of the Jewish people. When Mr. Sadat arrived in Egypt, in Jerusalem, the meaning was in the arrival itself. And behold, Esau came. They looked at the man more than they listened to his words. For he was breaking with 30 years of distance, denial, the cold shoulder, 30 years in which the Arab world had consistently attempted to eliminate Israel physically, in part by denying through contact the very fact of Israel's being. Sadat was lionized. He was a cynosure of all eyes, the eyes of the television camera and the eyes of the world. And the meaning was in the coming. But there were also words that were spoken that day and the next. And during the 44 hours that Sadat was in Jerusalem, the words that he spoke were of peace, and of the price of peace, and of the high price which would be exacted before peace would be achieved. His words were without compromise. He spoke the demands of the hardliners, full withdrawal from the territories that had been taken in the 67 war, a Palestinian entity, Palestinian rights, Arab sovereignty in Jerusalem. But somehow the world chose to look at the coming more than it listened to the words. But Sadat was clear. I have made my gesture. I have made my sacrifice for peace. It is up to Israel now. Israel requires some hard and drastic decisions. For the Israelis, it was almost enough that he was there. It meant that they could go to sleep that night and for some nights to come without fear of a midnight mobilization, requiring them to meet some Egyptian attack. It meant that after 30 years of struggling to be recognized, there were at least some Arabs and some Arab leaders who were willing at a price to accept Israel as a neighbor in West Asia, in the Middle East. Now, if Begin had gone to Cairo, it would have been a non-event. The Israel government has wanted recognition since its very beginning. Every Israeli prime minister has spoken of peace, recognition, and coexistence. It was the fact that Sadat, from the camp of the non-recognizers, had come to Jerusalem, the unrecognized capital, that made this a newsworthy event. And I was struck by the fact that the world was so taken by the drama of the occasion that it seemed willing to give Mr. Sadat the Nobel Peace Prize on the spot. And many were wondering, some aloud, some in print, some quietly, why it was that Mr. Begin and his government had not matched the courage, the high-mindedness of Mr. Sadat. Well, of course, President Sadat claimed that he spoke in the name of all the Arab world. But it was very clear that he was the only head of state who was there. And if Israel had given any unilateral compromises to Mr. Sadat, these would simply have been given away. It would no longer have existed for the hard bargaining that is yet to come with the governments that were not there. And I think it's important for us to recognize, for the world to recognize, the chance that Mr. Begin took, the courage that was his. In the first instance, he undertook a major security problem. Israel is a country which is not without Arab terrorists. Mr. Sadat had done something which obviously displeased the Arab hardliners. If Sadat had been assassinated while he was in Jerusalem, that world would have been plunged immediately into war. On that count alone, Begin took a great chance. But he took a greater chance, I believe, in the area of public relations, and he is not yet free of the danger in which he put himself. Begin welcomed Sadat to Jerusalem. He allowed Sadat to play the peace champion's role. But that role is not yet played out. It is not yet clear whether the act was simply shrewd and impulsive, and whether the same shrewdness and impulsiveness, which is a character, a hallmark of the character of Mr. Sadat, may not show itself again in a sudden reversal from this present position. This scenario is at least possible. On the 13th of December, or whenever the Cairo meeting is held, Ben Elissar and Meir Rozan, the appointed delegates of Israel, arrive in Cairo. Sadat is there to meet them. There are words of courtesy and welcome and peace at the airport. And then in some public confrontation, Sadat suddenly confronts them with this kind of dialogue. I have made the first step for peace. Why aren't you more forthcoming? What is Israel prepared to give? Say it now, say it out loud, say it for all the world to hear. And the Israeli ambassadors can only say to Sadat under such conditions, we are prepared to negotiate with you privately all the issues on the southern front. We have to get certain adjustments in terms of demilitarization, the Sinai control of Sharm el-Sheikh, and so on. But we are not prepared to negotiate with you about the West Bank or Jerusalem or the Golan because you are alone and the other Arab leaders are not here with you. And besides, we do not agree with the full statements which you have made to us. We are not prepared to give over all that you ask. And suddenly Sadat says to these men and to Barbara Walters in the TV world, I made my gesture. I try to establish peace. These Israelis are obstinate and they're demanding and they want their pound of flesh. He jumps into his plane and he flies off to Damascus to be reunited with his Arab brothers. There have been any number of impulsive acts in Mr. Sadat's career. 7 months after he came to power, following the death of General Nasser, he suddenly, impulsively turned against Ali Sabri and a number of the leaders of the Revolutionary Council had brought him to power, men who were to his left, and he threw them out of government and threw them into jail. And then in 1971, you remember he impulsively announced that that year was to be the year of decision. Either Israel would give back every grain of sand of Arab lands, or there would be war, and he could not make good on that pledge, and he had to eat his words, but he had made them nevertheless. And then 1973, he was able impulsively, decisively, resolutely to organize a war with Syria against Israel. And a year later, because he was angry that the Soviet was not willing to renegotiate the terms of his military debt, he suddenly impulsively ordered the Soviet out of Egypt, even though he had not made provisions for the refurbishing of his military equipment for spare parts for his planes and his tanks. And then a year and a half ago, he impulsively agreed with Secretary Kissinger to the Sinai Accords, though he violated then the stated unity of the Arab world. Mr. Sadat has a mercurial character. And though I do not for a minute doubt that he would like peace on his terms, I think it is foolish and naive for anyone to believe that this drama for peace has to be played out always within a, peaceful context within its present context. He may twist and turn again. And anyone who has followed the events in the Arab world in the last 30 years knows that yesterday's blood enemies become today's allies in a war against Israel, only to become tomorrow's blood enemies again. The involutions and convolutions of politics in the Arab world are a tragedy to behold, but they are very real. And before we award any Nobel laureate for peace to Mr. Sadat, let's give this whole drama time to play itself out, and let's make sure you really what is afoot. Now, that drama of Mr. Sadat's arrival in Jerusalem was heightened by the fact that it was so unexpected. I happened to pick up an issue of Time magazine, which had been published the week before the visit, a day or two after Sadat's speech to the Knesset. I tend to read Time not only for its highly editorialized news coverage, but because in the last months it has been very revealing in terms of where the major Arabists in our State Department are thinking and what they are thinking. You may recall just a few weeks ago they had a scenario there of how our government could twist the arm of the American Jewish community in order to leverage Israel to do what it wanted to do. And just this week they have what is tantamount to the Arabists in our State Department of line of what an imposed settlement would require in the Middle East. But in any case, this particular article dealt with the events of the week preceding Sadat's arrival. It had been a week in which had been marked by the PLO firing rockets at Nahariya, some of the northern settlements, and Israel's retaliation into southern Lebanon by bombing and cannon for those attacks. And the article featured the usual picture of neutral Arabs killed by Israeli guns, and the basic tenor of the article had to do with the fact that Israel had overreacted. It wasn't a tragedy that it was still an eye for an eye in the Middle East. Obviously, by inference, the Christian world would not act in such a way. And the article concluded by saying that things were getting harder in the Middle East. It was getting more difficult for America in its good intentions to bring the Middle East to Geneva because of this kind of escalation of violence. And of course, they reported that Sadat had said that he might be ready to come to Jerusalem, but they dismissed this as pure rhetoric. And they reported Begin's acceptance of Sadat's initiative without comment. And the concluding line of this article, which must be the ultimate triumph in punditry, neither leader is likely to visit the other's capital in the near future. The world did not expect this kind of summitry, this personal diplomacy, that's clear. And the world, after it took place, began to ask itself, why? How did it come about? Why did it take place? What were Sadat's motives? Now, Sadat said that he was taking a first step for peace. And there is no reason, I believe, to doubt that Sadat and certainly a number of people of similar mind in Egypt are determined that Egypt can no longer afford either a prolonged war with Israel or the no war, no peace position in which she now finds herself. In the four Arab-Israel wars, Egypt has lost more lives and lost more treasure than all of the other confrontation states put together. After the October War in 1973, there were a number of months in which Egypt, along with the rest of the Arab world, had a sense of euphoria. They had fought Israel, they believed, to a standstill, and they now had their honor back. But in Egypt, which is a country with a small but highly intelligent elite class, the perception quickly dawned that they had paid the price, they had the dead, and they had the increased debt. But there were a number of countries which had egged them on into this war and provided the military equipment for the war, which had profited and not lost a single life. Saudi Arabia, Persian oil states, Kuwait. These countries had had their incomes inflated four times because of the results of the oil embargo and the OPEC, the creation of OPEC. But Egypt was poorer than ever before. And you began to read in the Cairo Press and in articles which had analyzed the Cairo Press this kind of paragraph, which is a summation written about a year ago by Rifat al-Said. The Arab effort in October was not properly and equitably shared, nor were the results. While some willingly sacrificed their blood and the blood of the best of their youth, others simply accumulated large fortunes due to the gold that flooded into their coffers. The rich got richer, whereas those who initially spilled their blood had to turn around and spill their dignity, asking for a little of the material wealth that others had acquired because of the sacrifices made by the poor. Egypt had sacrificed, Egypt had fought the wars, and others had reaped the harvest, the benefit. And this kind of mood, compounded by the very real economic problems of the largest and in many ways the poorest of the major Arab states, has led Sadat to this position. He really cannot afford a prolonged war of attrition. In this century, the Egyptian population, which numbers someplace between 36 million and 40 million, has doubled six times. They've only been able to increase, even with the Aswan High Dam, the amount of arable land by two times. 70% of the population of Egypt remains illiterate. Despite the tolls of the reopened Suez Canal, despite a number of successful oil wells which have been dug in the desert south of Cairo and a few in the Abu Rhodes fields in the Sinai, Egypt has not been able to gather sufficient income through sales abroad to make up for the $1.5 billion of debt service which he owes annually to other countries. She is today something on the order of $13 billion in debt. In order to provide food at costs, at prices that the poor can afford, Egypt today must subsidize food to the extent of $2 billion a year. The budget cannot afford this kind of expenditure, but when in January of this year, Mr. Sadat tried to increase the modest food prices by some 30% in order to reduce the subsidy payment, there were bloody food riots, you'll remember, in Ismailia, in Cairo, and Alexandria. Egypt is today spending 50% of its annual budget for war-related items. And anyone who is at all aware of the extent of the domestic problems in Egypt recognizes that this kind of condition cannot go on endlessly. And Sadat has said this again and again. If you look back at his speeches before the October War, you pick up the same theme. We cannot afford endlessly to live in this condition of no war and no peace. So the budget, finances, as always, are a major element in the drama that brought Sadat to Jerusalem. And so, of course, is the army. The army is not prepared for another war. It's a year, 2 years away from such preparation, and it would require a major expenditure. A great deal of foreign equipment was poured into Egypt over the last 20 years. But when 2 years ago, Mr. Sadat ordered the technicians and the soldiers of the Soviet Union out, the supply of spare parts was reduced to a trickle. The technicians were no longer there to do the work that the Egyptians could not do, and many of his planes and many of his tanks are simply inoperable. The United States agreed about 6 weeks ago to refurbish the Egyptian Air Force in Europe, but it will take a good bit of time to accomplish that end. One of the reasons that the army in Egypt is supporting Mr. Sadat's move, despite the position one would assume an army and its leadership would take, is that they recognize their state of unpreparedness. And I believe also that the generals of Egypt have told Mr. Sadat what political leaders have often been told by their generals in the past, please don't involve us in a two-front war. Egypt knows that unless Israel is provoked, mightily provoked, Israel will not attack. Egypt is not about to provoke Israel at this moment. She may have some worries that some of the more hard-line northern neighbors might. But a real and most immediate military danger is to the west, in Libya. Three times in the last 7 years, the Egyptian press has reported a Libyan-sponsored assassination coup directed against Mr. Sadat. You'll recall that about 3.5 months ago, the Libyan army and the Egyptian army fought a costly week-long tank battle on the border between the two countries. You may not recall that about 7 months ago, the Egyptians helped their southern appendage, the Sudan, to abort a tank column which Gaddafi had sent down to try and take over the Sudan in a blitzkrieg attack. Gaddafi is a very real threat in the sense of being unpredictable, in the sense of being ambitious and megalomaniac to Mr. Sadat. And Mr. Sadat also must more than occasionally look at the rich oil royalties of Libya and say to himself, you know, if under the right conditions, if we could get control of those oil fields, a great deal of our financial problem would be behind us. So the budget, the army, and Libya are part of the explanation of what brought Sadat to Jerusalem. Another part of that explanation lies with Syria. Since time immemorial, since the days of the Assyrians and the Pharaohs, those who controlled the northern parts of West Asia and those who controlled the Delta of the Nile have been in a struggle for power and domination with each other. It's an old kind of endless battle. And in recent times, this battle has taken a new form. It's an economic battle. As long as Egypt was seen by Saudi Arabia and the United States as the key country which was the key to the establishment of a negotiated settlement in the Middle East, so long could she put demands on these two rich countries for aid, support, political and economic, and particularly financial. But in recent years, the Syrian government has solidified its control. It has become more powerful. In the 1950s and for most of the 1960s, government succeeded government in Damascus almost every other month. But 9 years ago, Mr. Assad came into power, and he's been able to solidify his control. He's been able to send his army into Lebanon, and in fact, they have sovereignty, effective sovereignty in Lebanon. Jordan is obviously totally dependent in terms of its foreign policy on the will of Assad. Hussein has no initiative, independence of his own in these matters. And if anybody can be said to control the PLO, the Palestinians, it must be Assad. In Syria, there's always been a nationalist ambition which is called Greater Syria. Syria, Damascus, was the provincial center during the Turkish Empire and long before, of a whole vast piece of territory which included Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, Syria, and parts of Iraq. And this ambition to return to these past glories burns, obviously, in many a Syrian heart. In the last 8 or 9 years, Syrian power has grown. Mr. Carter is the first American president who has had nice things to say about a Syrian leader. Despite Assad's hard line, Carter has found every possible pretext, and some when none existed, to declare Assad to be a peace-loving man, to declare his actions to be contributions towards Geneva and a negotiated settlement. Through the 1950s and 1960s, as Syria was essentially a Marxist socialist community, very little, if any, American aid went to Syria. In 1977, we invested our first major aid, some $300 million. And Sadat sees this as the beginning. If the United States and Saudi Arabia begin to see Syria as the pivot around which negotiations must revolve in order to achieve a settlement in the Middle East, if Syria is the true power, then Sadat has very little claim on either of the money bags, the United States or Saudi Arabia, to provide him with the Marshall Plan level monies, the 10 to 20 billions of dollars he so desperately needs to bring his economy back into shape. There's been very little foreign investment as such in Egypt. He needs to have government investment. At this point in time, the United States gives to Egypt 900 plus millions of dollars in economic aid, the largest amount of economic aid that we give to any country in the world. And he obviously needs more. And he's in a desperate struggle for power with Syria because he needs to have this kind of moral claim on the United States and Saudi Arabia that he alone can make peace, therefore, buy the peace through me, I'll make it happen. All of these conditions, I believe, contributed in one way or another to Mr. Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. And obviously in that part of the world, conditions change quickly. Events have their own episodic and erratic character, and what is true today may not be, in fact, true tomorrow. And that is why I think before any of us feels very sanguine about the events of the last 2 weeks, let's let some time pass and see how the events play themselves out. But obviously something has changed. If we take the image of a log jam in the river, let's assume that the lumberjacks were able to free the logs. Sadat was able to free this set of logs, and they begin to tumble down the river again. There's no guarantee, is there, that the logs will get all the way to the mill without falling into another jumble, a tangle, perhaps a worse one than before. And that's the question. The Middle East has been unsettled by the events of these last 2 weeks. Things are again up in the air. But what will happen is unpredictable. And no one, I think, can be sanguine that the complicated tensions and realities of that part of the world will suddenly, miraculously, be straightened out and resolved. Israel has talked of peace. Israel has talked of making the hard and drastic decisions. But it's not yet clear what hard, drastic decisions Mr. Begin and his government are prepared to make. The Israeli press in the last 2 weeks has been filled with the convening of what are called factions. These are little groups of members of the Knesset from within the Likud coalition who have met privately, a few at a time, because they are concerned that Mr. Begin is not prepared to make all of the concessions they believe ought to be made at this moment in time. In the short term, obviously, Israel has gained by the disarray that's in the Arab world. But in the long run, the reintroduction of the Soviet Union through this disarray, America's attempt to please the northern coalition led by Syria, the hardliners, in order to reestablish a unified Arab position may, in fact, hurt Israel very badly. Mr. Sadat has won himself a great deal of acclaim as a champion of peace. I read his mission to Jerusalem largely as a plea for attention, as I suggested, from the two rich countries of the area, Saudi Arabia, which has given guns but no butter, nothing for the budget, and the United States, which has given more butter than guns and 900 plus millions of dollars, but not yet enough. I think both Israel and Egypt moved as they did in order to upset the United States. Neither country has been pleased with the direction of Mr. Carter's foreign policy. So Egypt has been displeased by the courting of Syria. Israel has been displeased by the acceptance by the Carter government of most of the hard-line demands of the Arab world. And they were particularly unsettled, as you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks ago, with the joint Soviet-American communique, in which the United States government essentially pledged its moral support to a Palestinian state, to the return of all territories, to positions to which our government had never before truly been committed. The United States' role in the Middle East, though we like to think of it, the United States likes to think of it as that simply of an honest broker and mediator, has largely been that of a calculating mother who is determined to have all the chicks under her arm and moving them towards some goal that she has in mind by cajolery, by bribery, by love, by force, by a potch, by leverage, by all those ways which are the traditional ways in which you cajole people into doing things that they may not otherwise be willing to do. United States policy is determined on this principle, that there must be unanimity within the major forces in the Arab world for two reasons which are critical from the American point of view. The first is that only such unanimity will allow American commercial interests to interpenetrate the Arab world. And the second reason is that this unity alone will prevent the Russians from meddling in the Arab world and become a destabilizing, that's the State Department jargon, a destabilizing, an unsettling factor in the Middle East. And of course, that's precisely what has happened following the visit to Jerusalem. The visit to Jerusalem set up the hardline meeting in Tripoli. No great banners there, no recognition, no negotiations, no settlement. Sadat is there, PLO is there, Libya is there, Iraq is there, South Yemen is there, and the Russian influence is there. And clearly, the United States is now in the position where it's going to be very hard to reestablish the Arab consensus through which the United States was operating and moving everyone towards Geneva. The long-term consequences of the reintroduction of the Cold War into the Middle East are hard to gauge. The United States may respond by trying to outbid the Russians for the support that comes from the northern tiers of nations led by Syria. The United States may respond by throwing in its support to the southern tier led by Israel and by Egypt. That remains to be seen. If I were to speculate, if I were a prophet, I would suggest that the United States will choose the former route. It fits in with Brzezinski's and Kwan's position, their philosophy. And if so, this route is going to be one where America will move further and further away from the acceptance of those kinds of accommodations as to boundaries to Jerusalem, as to a Palestinian state which Israel believes to be necessary. The United States is the great loser of the events of the last 2 weeks. Clearly, the Sadat-Begin initiative was an attempt to free the policies of this government from the mother country, to free these countries, to allow them a certain independence of action because they didn't like where America was coercing them. But once you unsettle an area, it's very difficult to know where all the chips will fall. And no one knows whether Israel and Egypt would have been better off not striking out for independence so early before they were through with their adolescence, or whether they had the power to do so and to make it stick. I think Russia is the great gainer by the events of the last 2 weeks. Because whereas there was a consensus, more or less, in the Middle East, which everyone except Iraq and Libya, and they were tangential to those immediate concerns, agreed, now there is a large body of sentiment in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and surely within the more leftist elements in Egypt, to whom the Russians can appeal and from whom they can get certain kinds of support. I'm not a prophet. I'm not a son of prophet. That's a biblical line, lo navi anochi velo ben navi. I do not know what the days ahead have in store for Israel, for Egypt, for the world. I think it is better that these events took place than that they had not taken place. They suggest movement, and that suggestion was badly needed in many quarters. I think it's important that they tore down the American House of Cards, that somehow we would bring the countries of the Middle East through certain procedural agreements to Geneva, and something magical was going to happen at Geneva. No one ever spelled out how Geneva really was going to solve the problems in the Middle East. What was achieved once you sat a lot of people around a table without at all, without there being any kind of preliminary agreement as to what was going to be accomplished at that table? There could have been simply an endless sitting, an endless arguing, very little accomplished. The United States has set its goals on something magical called Geneva, and Geneva is really a very lovely, quiet, unmagical town. Magic is not known ever to have taken place in Geneva. So we're back to reality. We're back to the reality that the Arab world is not a unity. There are national concerns within the overriding Arab concerns. Sadat has obviously put his leadership on the line, though he has many ways, as I suggested, in which he can suddenly throw off this particular course and return to the fold. Begin has taken a very dramatic but dangerous task in accepting the gambit which was thrown to him. He's obviously enjoying the limelight. He's obviously making as much public relations hay as he can while the sun shines, but clearly he is not fully resolved what those hard and drastic decisions are, those compromises which Israel must be prepared to make. If Israel were in fact prepared to renounce all of the lands taken in the 67 war and to return to the condition before that war with certain arrangements made for Jerusalem, I would be more sanguine about the public relations battle which will ensue. But I don't think Israel is. I'm not so sure she should be. And I'm afraid that there are going to be many out there who simply want peace, that is, negotiated peace, a chance for their bank, for their industry, for their salesmen to make effective profits in the Middle East. That situation has not changed. Am I hopeful? No more, no less than I was 3 weeks ago. The one thing I know that I did not know 2 weeks ago is that there is more disarray in the Arab world than I had believed. The other thing that I do know that I did not know 2 weeks ago was that Sadat was a man whose impulses can sometimes lead to acts which may be of benefit to the world. He is not simply a narrow-minded political leader. But impulse is a dangerous quality in a leader, and it's one whose results we're going to have to see. Will there be peace in the Middle East? Not for a long time. Will there be war in the Middle East? Hopefully, not for a long time.